You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything. All right, this is The Brian Callen Show. Hunter, how are you doing today?
I'm rocking and rolling, thanks, Brian.
Yeah, you sure are.
I'm doing great. Doing really great.
I tell you, you can read a book very quickly. How long does it take you?
Well, it depends on the book. Some books you really have to think about as you read, and some books are written by John Grisham.
But there, for a guy, first of all, your book, you're getting a signing. You have a signing at Barnes & Noble.
At the Barnes & Noble at the Grove.
For your book, The Straight A Conspiracy.
That's right.
And tell us a little bit about, I love the idea of this, the most destructive idea in your opinion in education is the fact that some people are born smart.
Absolutely, because it poisons every choice that every student, every parent, every teacher makes.
In other words, I'm not good at this, so why try?
That's right. Yeah. You know, and the one thing that we know for sure is that practice matters, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of kids just simply aren't practicing, you know.
Every time I meet somebody who's really successful, like say, just say as an actor and stuff, they just work that much harder.
Mm-hmm.
You know how hard Christian Bale or Daniel Day-Lewis works?
Obsessively.
I don't know. Yeah, he's a good actor. He'll take 2 years to learn how to box and then go do a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I've never actually met anybody who's really successful who doesn't put out an enormous amount of effort.
Absolutely. Even people who, for example, say they only work 4 hours a week, you know, they work incredibly hard.
Yeah. Well, Tim Ferriss, who wrote that great book, I can tell you, Tim Ferriss, and I love that guy, he works a lot more than 4 hours a week. Tim Ferriss is a very hardworking guy.
Yeah, but they're hours,
well,
right?
Well, I think that the point of his book is the fact that there is a way to focus your energy. You can spend a lot of time working at the wrong stuff.
Yeah.
And it's really a question of deconstructing the learning process. We talked a lot about on this podcast the idea of the art of learning. That's so important, right?
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, it's working smarter, not harder, and all of that sort of stuff. And that's what Tim's really talking about. He's basically talking about, you know, how do you make sure that you're getting the maximum value out of your time? I mean, one of the things that I loved in his book was the idea of firing your worst customers.
Yeah.
Which is so great. Yeah. I can't tell you, like, I mean, everybody.
Yeah, because you spend so much time on a few, you know, shitheads. Yeah. And why do that? Yeah. Why waste your time on that?
That's right. That's right. So, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of insight and wisdom.
Well, when you read a book, is there a way to read a book that most people don't know about?
Well, the big difference that we talk about in The Straight A Conspiracy is that most people think that reading works like a cartoon character eating corn on the cob. So that essentially, you know, you go da-da-da-da-da-da to the end of the row, and then you go to the next row, and so on and so forth. And then what happens is people will read a whole page or whatever it is, and they'll be like, what the heck just happened?
Yeah.
Right? And really, it's much more like trying to solve a mystery, right? You're going around, you're looking words up, you're referring back to earlier pages, you know, you're thinking about like, oh, how does this connect to my own experience as an individual? Every two or three sentences, you're summarizing what you just read. You know, so it's not this linear process. It's really, you know, much more investigative and much more all over the place, where you're really trying to unravel what the text is saying.
Right. But is there a way to do that? I mean, how do you get the maximum amount of information into your brain? You know, I know we don't have the Google chip yet. So, I mean, and by the way, I don't know, even though that's a stated goal of Google, I wonder if that's even what knowledge is. That's certainly information. It certainly doesn't constitute knowledge. I was thinking about that. If you knew a lot about, you know, everything as far as it was, it doesn't mean you'd have deep understanding.
No, not at all.
Intuitive understanding, for example, how to do jujitsu or how to approach something in its context, in its whole context.
Well, the basic premise of the Google chip has already been tried. It's called our educational system, right? Where you try and cram as much information into a person's head as possible, and then you're like, and then they'll be smart. But the problem is that it's the ability to make sense of information. It's the ability to detect patterns. It's the ability to have
those. And apply it.
That's really what intelligence is. And so it would be, you know, I mean, much as I would love to have a piece of foreign matter in my brain that, you know, could potentially cause neurological damage, you know, I don't know that I'm going to be the first person to sign up. Let a few hundred thousand people, a million people test it out.
Yeah, no kidding. Then, I wait for the next iPad to come out before I buy a new one. I can't imagine the thing that's going to be in my brain.
Yeah.
That's going to be a huge hurdle. That's going to be a big effort, you know.
Oh, but there are always early adopters. There will be people who will be super, super excited.
There'll be lines.
Yes, absolutely. You know what I mean?
Well, I just think that so much of my education when I was younger was just needed context and needed relevance. It didn't have any of that stuff at
all. Absolutely.
You know, it just didn't have any of that stuff. I didn't understand why I was learning algebra.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't make any sense to me, man. And for that matter, same thing with history.
Yeah.
And the same thing even with literature.
Absolutely.
You're sitting there breaking down why the Scarlet Letter uses symbology and why, you know, why symbols are so important in the literature. Give me some context. I don't care.
Right.
I didn't give a shit about that stuff because nobody told me why it mattered. And part of it is very hard to get context when you're a kid.
Well, to a certain extent. But, you know, it's also the function of having an industry that is not accountable to its customers.
That's,
you know,
great point. That's exactly right.
You think about it, any other industry where, you know, your customers have to pay for the service that they're getting, right?
Yeah.
And they're paying because they expect some sort of outcome, right? That is
and
not,
if they don't like the outcome, they go to another service.
Exactly.
Provider.
You don't have that in the education industry. You know
right.
what I mean? You do have it in the entertainment industry.
Well, you know, Josh Waitzkin teaches, he's got a school where he teaches kids the art of learning through chess, music, and martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally understand that because once you understand how something works,
mm-hmm.
like the system itself, then you can apply those lessons to everything else.
And that's incredibly important going into the 21st century because the point is, you know, we don't know what today's kids are going to have to know in the long run. Like, it's an utter mystery to us, right? You know, industries
appear.
Well,
it really is,
you know what I mean?
I mean, this is an age of rapid destruction and
mm-hmm.
reconstruction, isn't
it? That's right.
I mean,
that's right.
It's innovation is happening so quickly. I'm just waiting for the next Twitter. And what's funny
mm-hmm.
is that I can't imagine anything besides Twitter because I'm such an idiot.
128 characters.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I need more of that. You know? But as an entertainer and as a comic, it's you know, it look at podcasting.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm getting people to my shows with my podcast way better than I did with any kind of radio.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and Joe Rogan was the one to tell me that. By the way, I'll be in Houston 11th, the 12th. Wait, I'll be in Houston, yeah, the 11th, the 12th, and the 13th at the Houston Improv. And then I'll be in Buffalo the October 17th, 18th, and 19th. And then I'll be in Calgary October 24th, 25th, 26th. So I'm pumped. I think at Yuck Yucks in Calgary. I love that place. So that's where I'll be in the month of October. And look at this. I'll be at the Punchline in Sacramento November 7th, 8th, and 9th. But that's kind of an example of being able to kind of advertise,
mm-hmm.
you know, for what I'm going to be doing using a podcast, you know. We were talking about, you know, the idea of this podcast and where we really want to go with this. And you know, we're going to have comics and we're going to have really smart academics and writers and stuff. And it's got to be more than just entertainment, man.
I think so. I mean, I think that's the thing is that, you know, people have a lot of drives, right? Human
yeah.
beings, they have a need, a desire to be entertained, but they also have a desire for meaning. They have a desire to understand the world.
Yeah.
You know, they have a desire for, I mean, you know, Daniel Pink in his book Drive talks about autonomy,
is
mastery.
Oh.
And, you know, I mean,
I got to read that.
It's a great book.
Let's get
it's a
him
great
on.
Book. Yeah, Pink is a great one to get on. All of his books are very good.
The book is called Drive?
Drive. And it's basically, you know, what he talks about in there is he talks about there's essentially three, you know, motivation 1.0, which was the model that persisted for most of human history, is the idea that essentially to get people to be productive, you whip them.
Right?
You know what I mean? And that led to the pyramids. It led to, you know, lots
That's so funny.
Yeah.
You have a good whip.
Yeah, a really good whip. And, you know, preferably, you know, you want the whip to break up into 9 pieces at the end, have some shards of glass woven in.
Get to work.
So, I mean, that's motivation 1.0. Motivation 2.0 is essentially what Adam Smith unleashed with capitalism,
yeah.
right? If you provide economic incentives for people, they will perform and they will innovate and they will do all sorts of great things,
right?
Motivation 3.0 is what we're really heading into now, right? Mm-hmm. And the point is that, you know, there are a lot of people who are working very, very hard today, and it's not necessarily for money. It's for things like autonomy. It's for a sense of mastery,
discovery,
getting better at something. All of those.
I think that's what I work for. I mean, I really don't. You know, I'm about to get this car now, and mm-hmm. If I really wanted to, I can afford a Tesla. I can afford mm-hmm. a really fast, really fancy car. Guess
that
what?
Runs only on electricity.
Yeah. Guess what? I'm getting the Passat.
Yeah.
And because I just can't spend $600 extra dollars a month because it's a fancy car.
That's right.
And what I was thinking about, what drives me is that, you know, you start to make some money, and I could always use more money. We could all use more money. But I don't know that the things that actually I need to make myself feel the way I do and the things that really motivate me would have anything to do with money. It really has way more to do with the idea that I'm trying to learn.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to write. I'm trying to create something out of nothing. I want to see what my imagination can bring forth mm-hmm. with this book that we're going to write
mm-hmm.
The screenplay I'm writing, or just my next 1 hour, your passion for education and, mm-hmm. and writing books. That's kind of, you know, when you try to isolate what you really are trying to do, I think that at the end of the day, what you're trying to do is make a difference, provide context, motivation, and inspiration for people who may not have access to everything. But one of the great things about the information age is that you can really pour the good stuff into your brain. You
Absolutely.
Can also pour a lot of shitty stuff into your brain. But what you can do when you pour the good stuff into your brain is, I think you can kind of, you can, in a way, somehow create a better world, in the sense that you illuminate your own ignorance, but you also learn how to inspire other people.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of brings everybody together in a way. Not to be too kumbaya about it, but I really do think that is sort of the idea. I love the differences in people, of course, but there seems to be movement toward a collective consciousness.
Well, I mean, I think that's the thing, right? Those differences are constructive, right? And that's part of how you're constantly iterating that shared worldview, right? But for effective action, there does need to be some sort of shared worldview. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There are certain values we need to hold in common.
Can you remember these seminal moments in your life, like that got you? You've always had a curious mind and done something about it, but you know, can you remember maybe the 3-4 seminal moments where you made a decision, and if you had made the wrong decision, you just wouldn't be who you are?
Absolutely. I mean, you know,
yeah.
And I mean, you know, you talk about a curious mind, right? That's something that I've arrived at. That's not where I started out. I mean, mm-hmm. when I was, you know, I mean, we had similar experiences growing up all over the world. And I remember at a very early age, like 3 or 4, because you move around and you move to different countries and different people are impressed by different things, right?
Mm.
And I remember just seeing on people's faces what would happen when someone mentioned they went to Harvard, right? It was like the universal. I mean, they call it, at Harvard, they call it the H-bomb for a reason.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
You drop that you went to Harvard and it has this effect and it's uh-huh. fairly universal. And so even from that very, very young age, I was like, I have no idea what this place is. I have no idea how you get there. But I know that I have to get there.
That's
like,
great.
It's amazing.
Wow.
That is.
Yeah. Those, when you see the effect on
mm-hmm.
I became a stand-up comic because I watched my father
mm-hmm.
laughing harder than I'd ever seen him laugh. And I was mm-hmm. in high school and I was like, this guy, my dad really likes this. He liked two things that really got him going: pro baseball players
mm-hmm.
and stand-up comics. And I was like, dude, I can't play baseball. I just can't hit a ball. They go too
yeah.
fast. I don't want to. I'm afraid of that pitcher. And I was a hopeless baseball player, but I could field, but I just couldn't stand in front of that plate.
Yeah.
It just made no sense that some dude was throwing a ball that fast at me. Forget it. I still can't believe I'm a comic. One of the, you know, it was amazing to watch my father laughing one time. He was dying. He was laughing harder than he did when I saw him at the guys, you know, when I was in high school.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but go on. So
I mean, you know, that was one of those.
So the point is, for anybody listening, is don't dismiss that when you have a very strong snapshot image
mm-hmm.
of what your dream of who you want to be, when a lot of times it's just what the effect the audience
That's
gives
right.
you. You know, sometimes you have an audience, you have an image of who you want to be,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of times that that is synonymous with the audience that you're visual, you're envisioning going, wow,
right.
Look at what John's doing or something. Don't dismiss that. That is a huge motivator.
Well, and
we are social, political animals.
Well, and in terms of what we talked about with John Haidt, right, there's the rider and the elephant, right? And I think there are certain areas of your life where, like, you know, let the elephant go. Right?
Oh, yeah.
If your elephant is saying, I want to be a stand-up comic, I want to go to Harvard.
Let it drive you. Don't try to drive it.
That's right. And then, you know, use the writer to figure out, okay, how do I make that happen?
I think that a lot of, you know, even physical problems, I would imagine, have got to be the fact that you keep trying to steer the elephant this way.
Oh, it's exhausting.
I mean,
that thing weighs, you know, 3 tons or whatever.
It's called the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, really hard to deal with that. And I think the same thing is... I mean, I haven't figured it out yet, but in terms of dating as well, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, there are all sorts of people who in your head are right.
Yeah.
And then there's the people who, like, on a gut level, you're like, this is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, why fight the elephant on those
ones? Well, the problem with the elephant on those ones is sometimes, you know, you can be attracted to a turbo slut with track marks and a tattoo on her neck. I mean, and I got no problem with that. I promise I'd move those kind of girls into my house and it'd just be a whole year lost.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful with that, man, because the elephant
can
just
be... Yeah, there are limits.
Yeah, relationships are so hard to figure out.
Yeah.
I just think they're a verb, and you just gotta, you know, some days you gotta realize that this sucks, and other days it's great. It's just one of those things, man. Yeah, that's hard in LA for a guy of your intellect and your curiosity and your interest. Finding somebody who can kind of match your value system, I'd imagine, is difficult.
I certainly haven't been able to do it yet. You know, I mean, you know, I'm still hoping, but
it's not easy.
But so that was definitely one of them for me. The other one actually was the first time I voted.
Oh.
And that was in the year 2000, Gore Bush. Mm. And I just remember voting and realizing how utterly clueless I was about everything.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the fact that I didn't have any idea of how, you know, the economy worked. And I was being expected to decide on that.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand education. I didn't understand health. Didn't really understand foreign policy.
Yeah.
Like, and that was really disturbing for me, just realizing that I was being entrusted with this very important decision. A lot of other people were being entrusted with this very important decision. And I was pretty sure that basically nobody had any clue what they were doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, that's why Republic Lost was so good, you know, and he uses that expression, Thoreau's expression, I see men everywhere striking at the branches of evil while none hitting the root.
The root, yeah.
You know, a huge part of understanding, a huge part of learning, and a huge part of being an effective citizen, an effective person is learning, like we were talking about, where to place your energy, knowing what to look at, knowing what to fight, knowing what to support. And man, there's a lot of information out there. And that's one thing Google can't solve for you.
Absolutely not.
You know, knowing
really...
In
fact, that's what Google can make worse for you.
That's probably true. But knowing, for example, that you and I have agreed after reading those books, So Damn Much Money and Republic Lost, they both make a very, very strong argument for the idea that campaign finance reform is what you have to start with before you talk about anything when it comes to politics. Money in politics and the way the incentive structure as it stands now is really robbing us of our democracy.
Absolutely.
I mean, my God, the people that matter in politics are fundraisers.
Yeah.
And not anybody else.
That's right. And it's, you know, I mean, I come from a biology background, right? And it's all about selective breeding, right? Mm. What selection pressure are you creating? And if your selection pressure is that, you know, you're trying to create this animal that, you know, has a very small head and a particularly curly tail, well, then, you know, you're going to end up with a Shih Tzu poo, right?
Yeah.
And if your selection pressure is the wilderness, then you end up with a wolf, right?
Yeah.
You end up with such totally different creatures. And the selection pressure that we have in modern politics is for a fundraiser.
Yeah.
And if we just all picture in our mind, what do we think a fundraiser is like? It's the exact opposite of a leader. It's a follower. It's someone who goes around and kisses everybody's ass to get as many dollars as possible.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
That's exactly right. And I think that the same holds true for exercise, nutrition, for what to read, mm-hmm. so you have deeper understanding mm-hmm. Of the world and perspective. I mean, most people get into relationships completely blind mm-hmm. because there's no manual. There's no one to tell you. I mean, there are people that have written stuff, but there's no one to tell you really how to have a relationship. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm, you mm-hmm. know, the only advice I ever got that I hold with me is my dentist one time said, learn how to fight. Mm-hmm. If you're in a relationship and you have kids, learn how to fight if you want to make it work. Mm-hmm. I went, that's really interesting. There's a way to do that. Don't mm-hmm. fight. You know, have boundaries and borders. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's a crapshoot, man. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it's just, I don't know. I don't mm-hmm. know. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's there's no answer. I don't know. I couldn't give you any advice on how to make a relationship work. Mm-hmm. I have no idea mm-hmm. because men and women are very different. Mm-hmm. I read a book by this guy Gottman. We should get on the podcast. A doctor who, you know, universally, boys and girls will essentially stop playing with the opposite sex by the age of 5, 6, or 7. Mm-hmm. By the time they're 7, their friends of the opposite sex are virtually nil, and that is a phenomenon across the globe. Mm-hmm. Men and women just separate naturally by the time they're 7. Mm-hmm. My daughter at 5 doesn't have any boyfriends. All mm-hmm. her friends are girls. Boys play with boys, girls play with boys, at girls. And that, by the way, is not cultural. That has got to be biological, because in every culture mm-hmm. in the world, mm-hmm. that is the case from the studies they've done. By the time you're 20 years old, 21, mm-hmm. that continues. Mm-hmm. You hang with your boys in college, mm-hmm. you hang with your girls in college, whatever. Now you get out into the real world, you're working with people, you move in with a girl, mm-hmm. And you don't know how that person thinks. Mm-mm. She's a very different creature mm-hmm. with very different perspectives and very different needs. Mm-hmm. And men are the opposite. So now you guys come together in this home, and you're trying to make it work.
And not only that, you're trying to do one of the most difficult tasks on the planet together, which is raise children.
Oh, forget it.
You know what I mean?
My God. And that actually can be a good thing, because it really does force you to confront who mm-hmm. you are and have respect for each other's points of view, even though you don't understand them mm-hmm. and deal with it. But, I mean, it takes a very long time to realize. When I think back, I mean, at 46 now, I've had a lot of practice. But when I think back, I mean, a girl did a short film. My friend Diana Gittleman, who's a really talented girl, and we dated for a while, and she was great. But she did it. She had me watch a short film, and the guy in it looks like me, and he was saying the things I said. And I went, this guy's terrible. This guy's a huge asshole. How did you date me? Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't realize. And what I was trying to do is I thought women should be like men. Mm-hmm. I couldn't understand how they were different. It didn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So I was like, why are you not thinking the way I'm thinking? Mm-hmm. Well, guess what, moron? They're different, and there's a reason they're different, and you need the difference. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I look back on my relationships, I realize I was basically wrong, and they were right. I just didn't understand them, and nobody showed me or taught me why I had to respect the difference. So mm-hmm. anyway, but going back to what we were talking about, I mean, so much of life, and I hope that this podcast, you know, this is the idea, and you know, maybe we can continue to try to kind of illuminate what's important to think about and what's important to, that's why we have very smart people on here who
yeah, are absolutely.
Talking about important issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the thing is that, you know, there are certain themes that are coming up again and again and again as we talk to these people. I mean, mm-hmm. one of them, for example, is incentive schemes, right?
Yeah.
You know, we talked to, when we talked to Charles C. Mann about, you know, why did slavery develop in the United States, in the southern United States? And it's because of incentive schemes. It's the incentive scheme that malaria created, right? When we talk about Republic Lost, right? If you have the right incentive schemes, right, you get a great system. If you have the wrong incentive schemes, you get a terrible system.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's also what's great is to begin to start to pull out, okay, what are those common threads, right? Mm-hmm. There's also, you know, back when we were talking to Kenneth Chase about the Mongols and all that sort of stuff, right? What you see is that, you know, people are not smarter. It's not so much that different races are smarter. It's just that they are rationally responding to their particular circumstances, right?
Right.
So, and I think those are the themes that are so important to being able to constructively make sense of the world and of history going forward. And that's really what's been missing, for example, in our schools and what's missing in our political discourse, what's missing in all this sort of stuff. I mean, you know, you look at race, right? What has happened to the conversation on race?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't. I mean, I don't think you can even talk about race in an honest way anymore. I mean,
mm-mm.
And also, you know, it's also become such a difficult thing to navigate in the sense that black people, you have Latino people, you have Asian people, you have white people in this country, all of whom are becoming minorities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, in Los Angeles, I think white people are going to be a minority fairly soon.
Mm-hmm.
So now what are we talking about here? You know, the power structure still is primarily white. But that is changing, and I don't know. I don't know what technology is going to bring. I don't know what's going on. I do know that there are segments of the population still being left behind, probably mostly African American. I think about that a lot. I'd like to change that somehow. Don't know how, but
well, I mean, I think. Listen, you know, the point is that we have never properly addressed slavery,
yeah.
Right? And you need some sort of narrative of human history that allows us to all understand, you know what, we all start from basically the same place biologically. And what happened was is that the unique set of circumstances that existed in the world at various points in time have brought us to this place.
Mm-hmm.
But now we need to figure out some sort of way that we can move forward from here based on our shared humanity.
I always say to people, you know, concerning slavery, we are still and still have been a nation with slavery. We've been around as a nation for 400 or so years. And I think the first slave was brought to this country in 1651 or something like
mm-hmm.
that. We will not be a country without that. That is a country that has been without slavery longer than we've been a country with slavery
mm-hmm.
until I think 2031 or 2041.
Yeah.
I mean, something like that, which I never thought about. So we've been. It's a very recent thing. So the residue of slavery is still very, very much in the air.
And I think that's the other thing, too, is I think it's a misconception to think that time heals all.
Mm.
The point is that time can pass, but unless you have some sense of, you know, making sense of the past and being able to move past it, you're never going to get that closure.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. I agree.
You know, and I think that's really what is needed, right? We need a new way of thinking about ourselves. I think essentially what's happened is you know, the civil rights movement. I mean, you know, right? So,
but I see. I'm also a big believer less in reconciling with the past. Actually, and I'll tell you why. I'm a big believer in figuring out techniques to get people now up to speed. Let's just take black
Absolutely.
People as an example. I want to figure out a way to get kids. In schools, in lower income areas or whatever, black kids. I want to figure out a way. I'm just using that as an example. There are a lot of other ethnic groups and white people for that matter. But let's just take that, for example. Let's take New Orleans. Let's take Baltimore, where you get these really big concentrations of black people that with no resources and not such a bright future in comparison to, say, people in Calabasas who are white. I want to figure out a way to create motivation and exposure
mm-hmm.
for those people to what is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take kids who are, you know, whatever they are, and they have sports programs and they have academic programs and things like that that teach them the art of learning and things, and they start seeing results, and you create a citizen out of those people that are viable, that can actually provide real value in a society,
mm-hmm.
then they got a house and they got a car and they got a career and they got friends and they got disposable income and they got freedom and they got imagination and all that stuff, then guess what? Their past and their legacy
anymore.
Doesn't fucking matter anymore.
Right.
That's something they read in the textbook. Yes, you have to honor it. Yes, you have to remember it. But it makes it a whole lot easier to come to terms with that. And that's
Absolutely.
What I want to see. You know, forget this talk about reparations. I think this stuff drives me crazy. I want to see a way to create a scaffolding and an incentive structure to get people like that onto the next level.
Let me ask you this. Is that incentive structure already in place?
I don't know. I don't think so. My issue is, well, I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's the thing,
right?
I'm not
a social scientist, but, you know, I don't think so.
I mean, that's, so much of what we're dealing with in the straight A conspiracy, right, is that, you know, the dialogue about education is all about what can be done on the federal level, right? We need more books, we need more teachers, we need more schools and all that sort of stuff. Well, that's great. And it would be really, really nice to have all of these things. But the government is broke.
Hmm.
Right? You know, there are fundamental problems.
They're about to shut down.
They're about to shut down, yeah. Right? So the point is we have to figure out what do we do with the resources that we have. And the reality is that the biggest opportunity, right, which is also the biggest failure in the educational system, is not lack of resources. It's lack of use of resources, right? Hmm. Students don't read their textbooks. They don't talk to their teachers. They don't take advantage of all the great resources that are now available online. And the reason why is because they don't believe that they're capable of doing it. They don't know how to learn. These are like very fundamental. I mean, you know, kids that I've tutored kids who are in the foster programs, and I've tutored kids whose parents have $1 billion, right? And the thing is that whether you're going to the fanciest school in the world or the worst school in the world, most kids don't know how to read.
Yeah.
Like the sort of reading that we're talking about, right, where you're not just going line, corn on the cob style. That's what even the kids at the fanciest schools are doing.
Yeah.
You know, so what we really need to do is we need to change people's understanding of human intelligence. We need to change the way that people approach material. We need to teach people how to teach themselves.
Show me, tell me, and the book is The Straight A Conspiracy, by the way. But show me, and we got to put that on our website. Is that on,
it's
on the website?
Website. All the books that we mentioned on the podcast are on the website.
Okay.
And of course, if you buy them through the banner ad, then money goes to Brian.
Yeah. Right? You haven't made a dime yet, but you're going to.
Well, nor have you.
That's true. well, that's because, you know, Mike and Rena do all the work
as far as
all the technical work and have been for many. Mike's been doing my... You know, Mike Hazantin's been doing my website and all my social media forever.
Yeah.
At really not a lot of money.
Yeah,
so
you want to talk about reparations?
I was like, dude, let me help you out here. What were we talking about?
You were talking about in terms of teaching people how to teach themselves.
What would you, give me an example. If I put you in I make you all powerful and I put you into a troubled school in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen The Wire. what the frick do we do with those kids in that kind of a school? What would you do?
Well, there are a lot of people who are doing these sort of things. I mean, if you look at the KIPP program, right? Some people love it, some people hate it, but they've been remarkably effective. And KIPP, Knowledge is Power. It's a series of charter schools, and it really started out with the couple of guys who were doing Teach for America down in Texas, and basically they said, "Oh my God, what a disaster this is! How do we change it?" Mm-hmm. And what they do is, you know, they do things that a lot of these charter schools are doing. You know, it's about creating that sense of aspiration and that sense of culture, right? So, you know, the rooms are named after the fanciest schools. They're named Georgetown and Harvard and all that sort of stuff. You know, they have uniforms. You know, it's very disciplined and all that sort of stuff. And there are a lot of, you know, that's to mention one, the largest one. They're about to, KIPP, I know, because I talked to somebody who's about to set up a KIPP middle school here in Los Angeles. They're about to set up 12 more schools here in Los Angeles.
Mm.
Their middle school is the best middle school in the entire LAUSD program.
Wow. Do they have trouble with the teachers' unions and all these things?
It's like all of these things. Anyone who's trying to do anything in education is going to be loved by some people and detested by others for whatever reason.
How do you feel about the teachers' union?
Well,
complicated question.
It is a complicated question. That's part of it. But it's also like asking someone, how do you feel about racism? You know what I mean? It's sort of like, would you care to wander into this minefield? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think that's the thing. You know, there's a reason why unions exist, and unions exist to be able to make sure that, you know, the little guy is not abused by big business, big government, whatever it is. But, you know, there are certainly problems that come with unions, and that's any union. So, you know,
what about tenure and waiting for Superman and all that stuff?
Well, I mean, again, like there are problems there. I think the biggest thing is listen, I tend to come at this from the perspective of the individual student, the individual parent. And the reality is that these large, very complicated questions, we can debate them endlessly.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The problem is that
that's a great point.
Yeah, you're not gonna fix them until you fix campaign finance. And to fix campaign finance, you first have to convince everybody that campaign finance is a problem and is the issue that needs to be fixed and all that sort of stuff. So if I'm a parent or I'm a student, I'm like, listen, the system is broken. It will continue to remain broken and will not be fixed by the time I graduate. So I have to figure out, how do I get myself an education with the resources that I have available to me?
Right.
If I can find myself, for example, waiting for Superman, if I can find my way into a great charter school, awesome, right? But even if I can't, like, how do I give myself the best possible education? Because the reality is, I can't wait on the government or someone else to come and solve this problem for me. Because we're not in good shape.
They're not capable of it.
Yeah.
That's the biggest issue.
Well, and this is where you really come down to, who is in charge of your education? Who can fix your education? You.
Yeah, you.
Because the key to education is, how do you manage your attention? Where do you put your attention? And the only person who will ever control where your attention is you.
Well, I think that you're going to probably see, and you already are, you're going to see a lot of education being done in people's homes, off their computers. Why in the world would I want to go to some bad school, for that matter, spend a fortune to go to Harvard and go to that campus and get myself into $200,000 worth of debt when, for $5,000, I can get a sick education and learn from Princeton, Harvard, Yale professors?
That's right. And so, the reality is, there's so many things that are the model of education that we have. And back in episode 2 of the Brian Callen Show, when you were kind enough to have Katie and I on, Katie said, we have an education system that is awesome for the industrial age. And that's, not the age that we live in.
Very interesting. So do you think that's going to, we're going to start seeing online education just explode?
We're already seeing online education explode. I think the real problem that has to be solved is not education. The real problem that has to, well, there's two things, right? So everybody's very excited about the Khan Academy and all of that sort of stuff. And that stuff's great.
But what is the Khan Academy?
Khan Academy is basically Salman Khan, right? Who was a guy who, I don't remember, he was like an investor, venture capitalist, startup guy. But he was basically helping his nieces and nephews with their math homework and stuff like that. And, he would talk to them on the phone and teach them over the phone. And then at some point, he was unable to make the scheduled time with his niece. So he's like, oh, okay, so I'll upload a video explaining the thing, right? So he uploads the video and,
gets an idea.
Well, no, he doesn't even get the idea. He gets the idea from her, right?
Oh, wow.
Because he says, oh, okay, so for the next one, what time works for you? And she was like, actually, could you just upload a video? I like that better. Because when we talk on the phone, I get intimidated by you. And with the video, I can control it. I can go back. I can control, what I'm watching and when and all that sort of stuff. I can rewatch it and all that sort of stuff. And he was like, oh, my God, this is so simple.
This is an idea.
Why don't I just do this? And so literally he just started uploading all of these videos of him, here's how you do fractions.
Jiu-Jitsu guys do that with the Gracie Online University.
Exactly.
Everybody's doing it.
Yeah. And so he set up this nonprofit called KhanAcademy.org. And, has gotten millions of dollars from Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation because they love what he's doing. Absolutely. Because, dollar for dollar, what an amazing return. And, if you go on their website, you'll see they advertise there how many lessons they've delivered, right? And they've delivered, I can't find it right now. But anyway, they've delivered just an insane number of lessons over time.
Really?
Right. Millions and millions of lessons, right?
Kind of like Woody Allen, you did it. Millions.
It's a tribute to John Lovitz.
A whole bunch.
But so the thing is that that's all great. And, from our perspective, that's step one, right?
Right.
Problem is step zero is that people need to know how to learn to be able to take advantage of that. They have to have the confidence in their intelligence.
And by the way, I guess you've got to build a base first. And then there's nothing worse than somebody who doesn't have a base education and then go from there.
Because
then you don't have context, That's why I asked Daniel Robinson what he would read, the Bible, You got to have a command of the New Testament to see, and even the Old Testament, to see how everything kind of, so much of our education and justice system was influenced by the Bible, and then also how much of our education system, how much of our the way we live now was also a rebuttal to the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Umberto Eco, who is this amazing Italian novelist, but he wrote this op-ed piece, I think it was, you know, a few years ago, 2009 or something like that, basically about walking around the Louvre and, you know, overhearing these kids saying, "Who are those creepy old men and why are they looking at that baby?" And it was a painting of the three wise men.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah.
There you go.
I don't remember if it was that story, but the point is that he overheard numerous kids, numerous teenagers who were looking at these paintings and are like, "This is super weird."
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's because they didn't know the Bible. And obviously what you're seeing a lot of schools doing now is they're starting to teach Bible as literature classes,
right,
where it's free from the religious context.
Yeah, how do you read Shakespeare without having a sense
of the Bible?
You know?
Right.
And why do you read, why Shakespeare? Why is that important?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a huge influence on a lot of other. Yes, it's the origin. You have to know every play, but just know his contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Know Isaac Newton's contribution. You know, there are the seminal thinkers. And once you understand that, then you can go from there.
Well, and then you have a roadmap. And the point is that then you can, you know, fill in
the Bible,
details.
Aristotle, Socrates, you could probably go from there too. You go to the Bible, you go to the Greeks, the dialogues, Plato's dialogues. I would say, here's my thing. You got the Bible, you got Plato's dialogues. You've got you could almost skip to the Enlightenment.
Those...
at least know who Shakespeare was and kind of an idea. Well, you know what, though? You need, besides the Greeks, besides the dialogue, you need to know, like, some drama. Sophocles, Euripides, Aeschylus.
Well, those lessons. The more the merrier. But
there are
certain really big ideas that are needed. You know what I mean?
Like, give me them.
Well, I would say, for example, Guns, Germs, and Steel, that whole premise, right? That the reason why the West got rich was because they had access to better food technologies, right?
Yeah.
The Columbian Exchange, which we talked about with Charles Seaman, right? That it was the exchange of crops like corn and potatoes and, you know, horses, pigs, and sheep across the Atlantic that ushered in the modern age, right? Those are really, really big ideas. Why
which
nations
fed a lot of people and killed a lot of people.
Absolutely.
With disease, yeah.
You know, Why Nations Fail, I think, is, you know, I mean, such an important book. And the premise is there that, you know, societies that really include as many people as possible in political decisions and include as many people as possible in economic life outperform, right? And that's why capitalism and democracy work really well, because the point is...
You're suggesting that there should be no immigration reform? Open the borders? Maybe.
Well, there are certainly challenges that come with immigration. But, you know, the point is, I think that there are these big seminal ideas. The other one that I would read, which was super important to me, was Locke's Second Treaty on Government. Which is, after I had that experience in 2000 where I was in the voting booth and had no idea what I was doing, I sort of didn't do anything about it, of course, because you have the idea and then you proceed to, like, do nothing, right?
I think reading the Constitution and the Federalist Papers and
all of that stuff.
And it's really important. Understand how your government works.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Understand how the government works.
Well,
and sometimes, to an extent, who the thinkers were, that it wasn't the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers were steeped not only in Greek philosophy, but they were also steeped in they understood the Bible, and they certainly understood John Locke and David Hume and all those philosophers that kind of
they actually read the most of. I read a very interesting article about, like, what did the Founding Fathers read? And the point was that they were actually very skeptical in general of political philosophy. Mostly they avoided that because they were like, that's theory. Like, how do we know if that practically works?
That's right. They solved the political problem in a lot of ways by saying, can you imagine living in Plato's Republic?
Right.
The first fascist? No, thanks. Even Aristotle believed you could leave children out to exposure. He talked about magnanimity and stuff, but that's kind of where religion, in my opinion, Christianity plays a very big role and an important role. I'm not a Christian, but I have a great deal of respect for the idea that we are all of the same moral worth. Your life, just because you're a homeless person, is worth as much as mine in terms of how the law sees you. You don't get to kill me just because I'm in the way. That's very important.
Well, and that's where, I mean, this, you know, in terms of big myths that float around, another big one is the Scopes monkey trial.
Yeah.
And it was actually, see, the Scopes monkey trial, right, this guy tried to teach evolution, and then, you know, the yeah. story that we hear in the play Inherit the Wind is that, you know, this guy comes in who's this religious bigot, and, you know, he tries to stop the march of science and all that sort of stuff.
The theory of evolution.
Right. Yeah. There was a book that was written a few years ago called Summer of the Gods, which won the Pulitzer Prize. And it's basically all about the Scopes monkey trial. And what you find out in there is that the book that they were trying to teach evolution from was a eugenics book. It was saying, because there is evolution, you can therefore
kill off
the weak. Exactly.
That's right out of the Nazi handbook.
That's right. And yeah. So the reason why...
So we can control our own evolution.
That's right. And the reason why William Jennings Bryan opposed that was because he really did come from that Christian sense that you're talking about of all men having worth, all being created
Thank
by God.
God. Thank
Absolutely.
God.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, we'd be killing off people who are handicapped,
mm-hmm.
people in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to live in a society like that.
That's right.
But that's where you get into this issue of controlling our own biology, controlling our own evolution, which, by the way, both those debates very alive today.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that right now in Texas, you've got people on the Board of Education who want to teach creationism,
mm-hmm.
even though there's really no scientific evidence for it. You know, I got no problem with you taking umbrage with Darwin's theory of evolution. There mm-hmm. are scientists, credible scientists, who say there are holes in this theory.
Well, but
the burden then is on you to come up with another theory that is scientific that I can sink my teeth into. Don't tell me just because the Bible's I'm not interested
right.
in your Bible. I think it's great that you want to you believe in the ideas of and live the life that Jesus Christ did.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of power in forgiveness and loving your enemy and turning the other cheek and all those things and being a good Samaritan and treating people as you would have them treat yourself. Yes, very powerful ideas. Forgiveness is a very powerful, powerful idea. I don't want to live in a world without that.
Mm-hmm.
But please don't tell me that I have to teach the Bible as literal truth.
Mm-hmm.
I like it as symbology. I like it as a guide. Don't mm-hmm. tell me that it should be on the same par educationally as the theory of evolution, because I can't measure one. I can the other.
Yeah. But I mean, that, you know, if you want to talk about those big ideas, most people don't understand the scientific method. The point is
that's
that—
That's very true.
You know? And
the empirical, the scientific method. The idea that science is always very, very closely tied to doubt.
Yeah.
Always doubting its
That's
own
right.
results.
And so, you know, so many of those arguments that you see where they're like, well, evolution is just a theory, right? Mm-hmm. The point is that, yes, and that's appropriate, because the point is that everything in science is a theory. Gravity
yeah.
is a theory, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's not
but
that—
Guess what? It works.
Things fall down.
My biggest problem with people who believe in psychics and believe in the occult and stuff, you know what my problem with that is? That sloppy thinking that they can't prove at all,
mm-hmm.
that they just a feeling they have. That same kind of thinking and that same kind of wishy-washy sort of like unsubstantiated belief was used to burn women at the stake because they were witches. It was used to bleed people when
mm-hmm.
they were sick.
Mm-hmm.
It was used
it
to do
bled
all...
George Washington to death. George Washington had the flu and his doctors bled him to death.
There you go.
You
there
know
you go.
What I mean?
So that's where belief in things like the occult is destructive. It's a stupid way to think because it historically has always led to a great deal of misery and shame and even death.
Well, and that was in the Salem witch trials, right? That was the crucial thing. That was where it went wrong, is because
yeah.
they basically said that supernatural evidence could be admitted to the court.
Well, they would bless a body of water.
Mm-hmm.
They would hang an old woman over the water. If the water that was blessed took her in other words, if she sank, then she was not a witch. If she floated, she was a witch. Here's the problem. A lot of women, there was a famous surgeon who was a very good surgeon and ahead of his time, and I can't remember his name now, said these women are suffering from osteoporosis. Their bones get very brittle and light. They lose calcium. So, of course, they're going to float.
They're
going to float much easier than will a young woman. But you know what? That's science.
Yeah.
That's in the way. You know, let's burn her because she's a witch, because she keeps cats. And because she's schizophrenic or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And instead of being able to isolate what's going on in somebody's brain because they happen to have a mental illness or something, nah, she's a witch, let's burn her at the stake.
Right.
That's where the fight lies for me.
Well, and I think that's the thing is what you're really talking about. What Aristotle and Socrates and all of these people and, you know, the great thinkers tried to do is they went back to first principles and they really examined their most fundamental conclusions.
What they call
first things, that's right. And they tried to then build from that, always checking each of their premises.
Yeah.
And I think
who is the primary mover? You know, if everything has to be moved, you know, all those kinds of ideas.
And I think that's, you know, everybody has a responsibility to build a worldview for themselves and constantly be checking every single premise and making sure that every premise is true. You know what I mean? And that's the responsibility that comes with having a brain.
Yeah, absolutely.
Having a human brain.
That's where I understand people who have you know, like Matthew Arnold and those guys who said, you know, we're not just smart monkeys. There's got to be more than that. It's like Dan Robinson said, when you start breaking us down, you're just going to reduce us to our mathematical biology and suggest there's nothing else out there than I can practically hear the machinery clanking in the garden. It's true. I have to believe that our consciousness and our potential to continue to do what we do for the sake of things like beauty and wonder and I don't choose to live in a world strictly that can be explained with math and science. I like the idea that there is something otherworldly or something. I like believing that. I guess I like believing in God. I like believing in something that's irrational that I can't explain. That's ultimately benevolent. I like that. I guess I'm a romantic. I guess that's the difference between a romantic and a scientist. I guess that's the difference between a romantic and a scientist.
Well, the two are not mutually exclusive, and I think that's one of the interesting things is that, you know, Newton himself was deeply scientific and deeply religious.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's what makes me so sad about creationism and all of that sort of stuff is that Newton believed that, you know, that God had basically written two great books. One was the Bible and one was the universe.
Mm.
And you wanted to read deeply in both in order to be able to understand the creator.
Yeah.
And imagine if all of that energy, instead of being, you know, devoted to trying to defend, you know, young earth creationism was put into trying to understand the universe, trying to understand
the
world.
Well, because it goes back to suggesting that God, the problem with the atheists is they're assuming that they know what I am saying when I talk about God. My God, I mean, for the most part, I'm talking about, it's very humbling to think of how much there is to know and how little I know, how insignificant I am, all of us are. And so that's when you start talking about God in that sense, at least for me, man, it's a very humbling and actually quite inspiring idea. You know, I was listening to NPR today and on the way here. And I really love the idea that you just can't keep the human spirit down. You can certainly do it to individuals, but at the end of the day, suffering's example lives on, and it inspires. You know, there's this guy in Angola, not in Africa, but in the Angola in Louisiana.
There's an Angola in Louisiana?
Yes, but I said Angola because I like saying it that way.
Oh, okay.
And it's a terrible prison. It's
a terrible prison.
Yeah, they keep people in solitary confinement for 40 years sometimes. And it's very hot in the summer and very cold. And it's a terrible, terrible place. It's kind of one of Dante's rings, you know.
Wow.
And they did a documentary called The Farm, which was about this. And mostly black people who were unrepresented and got in these jails. Now they work in these terrible conditions and life expectancy is really bad and everything else. This woman, and I want to get her on the podcast. I just heard her talking, and it was so moving. And her name, she was a student. Her name is Jackie Simmel. And she starts talking to this guy named Herman Wallace, mm-hmm. who is, I think, on his deathbed right now in a, mm-hmm. In a prison hospital. And he'd been there for, he was in solitary confinement, I think, for 30, 40 years. And there really wasn't any, I guess his case was, there was a lot of evidence he was wrongly convicted, and it was just a huge injustice. I think he was part of the Angola Three. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that she did for him was she bought him some property and bought him a dream house and had him decorate and basically had him tell her over the phone what he wanted in the house he'll never live in. And there was an excerpt where he was saying the gardenias and the tulips are very important because they'll make the children smile when they walk by. And he was doing the singing. I got to tell you, man, it was the most moving thing in the world. Wow. Because he was through his imagination describing and designing in real time mm-hmm. the house he would have loved to have lived in. Mm-hmm. His flesh and bones die, but his legacy and his idea and mm-hmm. his imagination lives on in this structure because mm-hmm. of this woman, Jackie Semmel. That was very moving to me, man. Mm-hmm. It was very inspirational to me. And mm-hmm. even though it was very sad, that guy who's now dying in a hospital bed has certainly made my life a better place.
Absolutely, because you heard his story. And
yeah,
I think
and now I'm talking about it on the podcast, and everybody else is going to hear it.
And I think that's the point, is that really what we're talking about is that both religion and science can be used to keep down the human spirit. And that's ultimately the most important thing, is that joy to discover, that joy to learn, that joy to improve oneself, the joy to aspire. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? The pursuit of happiness, in short.
Thank you,
Thomas Jefferson.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That's a good way to end this podcast, brother. We were going to have somebody, a guest on, but we just got lost in conversation here. So this was awesome. I wanted to do this anyway with you, actually.
Okay,
I wanted to have kind of a conversation with you about your book and about your thoughts and this was kind of the Hunter Motz podcast.
Well, I mean, I also think it's important for us periodically after we've had all of these guests to
sort of recap.
Recap and compare notes and see what have we learned? What are the big ideas? How has it shifted our thinking?
Who stood out the most as a guest for you?
I mean, I don't want to have favorites.
They were all great though.
Yeah. And I mean, the opportunity, so many of these people I've had such an intellectual crush on for so long.
The
fact to be talking to them, is.
I don't have a favorite, so I was just asking
They're all, thanks for setting up a trap.
Yeah. I thought as I asked the question, I go, I don't know if I could answer that question.
I mean, there were so many great people. I mean,
Well, who was the last guy we had on?
Tim Snyder was amazing. Amazing.
Tim Snyder was great.
Yeah. Last one was Charles C. Mann, who
was
great. Mind-blowing.
I loved him, man. I learned a lot.
That was
really cool.
John Haidt.
He was great.
Was awesome.
Yeah, John Haidt.
You know what I mean?
Happiness Hypothesis.
Happiness Hypothesis and the Righteous Mind.
Yeah.
There have been so many great
Dan
ones.
Dan Robinson, of course.
Yeah. Josh Foer.
Yeah, Josh was great.
Great.
Man. Josh was great. We had great guests.
Yeah, it's been really,
this is
really fun.
This is the greatest podcast of all time. That's all I'm looking for. ladies and gentlemen, this has been Brian Callen, and he is supposed to say Hunter Motz.
Oh, and I'm Hunter Motz. I thought he was going to say, and he is appearing at blah, 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 blah.
Oh, well, he is appearing in Houston and in Buffalo and in Calgary in the month of October. Go to briancallen.com. I'll see you there, man. Thank you, everybody. Thanks,
Rena. You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.